Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, we'll talk with Warren Clark, creator of the illustrated booklet The Mystique of Spanish La Florida.
And that's what the illustration is really focused on. And I think the energy moment pries open what the story is about, and maybe that deeper truth that's there that that story brings to us.
We'll discuss Tamuquin healing practices.
Sorcerers receive special interest from both the Spanish and French.
And we'll talk about the edible education experience. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. So I remember every picture tells a story, don't it? Every picture tells a story, don't it? Every picture tells a story. Starting in the 1980s, Warren Clark provided illustrations to accompany interesting facts about Florida history that ran in 50 newspapers throughout the state. He has now assembled a booklet called The Mystique of Spanish La Florida, published by HistoryIllustrations.com in St. Augustine. Gathering Florida history is a family affair for the Clarks. In the 1980s, Warren took his daughter Jessica and son Nathaniel on explorations around the state. Warren's father, Sid Clark, designed the base for the Great Cross erected in 1965 for the 400th anniversary of the founding of St. Augustine, and he dedicated the Mystique of Spanish La Florida to his mother, Mildred Tabb Clark.
What she would say to my father when we were riding around, and she would say, oh, there's an historical marker, and she'd say, sweetie, let's go back and see that, and would you read it to us? And his baritone voice, and he would read that out to us. Oh, a fond memory. And I think that instilled in me a love of history.
Jessica Clark is a TV reporter and news anchor in Jacksonville and is helping her father, Warren, promote his illustrated booklet.
Well, it's interesting to hear Dad say that, because that's what Dad did with us when he'd see a historical marker then. And so my brother's, 3 years younger? Mm-hmm. And so Dad would pop us into the car and drive all over Florida with a map, you know, one of those paper things.
It was actually the Atlas and Gazetteer. So we had like 20 or 97 pages of Florida up close.
Yeah.
Get all those back roads.
And get all the back roads, of course. Oh, yeah. Because that's where so many stories are. Mm-hmm. I know I'm a reporter today because of Dad in so many ways. And that's one of them.
Throughout The Mystique of Spanish La Florida, Warren Clark encourages people to visit historic sites. The booklet contains colorful illustrations and a lot of important information in the text.
Well, at first, the target audience was children. And so fourth grade kids come here to St. Augustine from all over the state. They are really a presence here in town. This is their fourth grade Florida history class. And so that was it originally. But actually, even early on, when we had these in newspapers and publications in the 90s, about 50 publications and about 500,000 readers in all, it was the person who's going to sit down with a cup of coffee, read their newspaper, see a single panel illustration like this, and about 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds, they're going to read something and go, wow, I didn't know that. And then I wanted to tell them where to go nicely. And it was, you know, to go to this place so that you can experience it for yourself. So that was more of an adult audience for somebody reading that. But a child would pick up that newspaper. That may be the only thing that child's going to read, too. My real target audience is for people who found history pretty boring in school and couldn't care less about history, and get to them in a very short, quick period of time by focusing in on where's the energy moment in the story. And that's what the illustration is really focused on. And I think the energy moment pries open what the story is about, and maybe that deeper truth that's there that that story brings to us.
And they're they're thin. They're thin books. And so it's not intimidating. You're not picking up a 3-inch tall or thick history book. This is something you can pick up, spend 5 minutes, learn something, put it down, pick it up again when you have another moment or two, and they're fun.
The booklet is fun, but also substantive. Warren Clark cites well-known Florida historians who helped him with accuracy, including J. Michael Francis, Roger Smith, and Charles Tingley.
Well, Charles, at the St. Augustine Historical Society Library.
Charles Tingley
would say, Warren, it really didn't happen this way. Or he'll say, Warren, everybody wore hats and you don't have any hats on people. But the one that really did me in was, he said, Warren, in 1702, the Castillo de San Marcos looked different than the way that you got it. We drew it up as it is now. And so I had to really, really work hard on that illustration.
Clark includes many interesting but lesser known facts in his booklet, including how Columbus almost discovered Daytona Beach.
He was sailing due west. He was like, I know it's over there somewhere west, and we need to go as directly west as we possibly can. And he knew that food and everything else was going to run out. And then they saw birds flying southwest. And Pinzon, who was his excellent navigator, was all over Columbus. And he was saying, hey, you got to go follow the birds. The birds are going to be going to land. And if we go there, we'll find something. And we need to find land soon. And so finally, Columbus gave into it. But when you draw the trajectory of where they were sailing due west, they would have landed in Daytona Beach. And I don't know, but that may well have changed a bit of some of our history that we have here in Florida.
In his illustrated booklet, The Mystique of Spanish La Florida, Warren Clark mentions several instances where Spanish clergy in Florida advocated for better treatment of Native Americans by the Spanish. He explains how Father Luis Cancer was clubbed to death by natives before he reached the shore.
And that was a priest, Father Luis Cancer, in, 1549, and he had really helped pacify an entire area in Central America, not through weapons, but through treating people with justice and fairness, the indigenous people, and changing the Spanish attitude so they were doing that. And so he wanted to bring that same message of love to a place where in Florida, Hernando de Soto had really pretty much ramped and pillaged all the way through his exploration, and other explorers too. He wanted to bring that message here. And he did not want to be taken to the same place where De Soto had landed. And that's exactly where that ship's captain took him. Who knows, the captain may not have loved peace-loving priests.
Another illustrated panel describes the discovery of the Gulf Stream by Ponce de Leon. Warren Clark.
I think that is one of the pivotal stories in our history, Ben, in Florida, and Spanish Florida. Because here's Ponce de Leon right off the coast of Miami. And he has got a strong wind, and he's trying to sail south against a current that is pushing him backwards. And he's going like, wow, there's some force that's going on here. That was the beginning of the discovery of the Gulf Stream. And that Gulf Stream brought the Spanish treasure ships right up and across over to Spain.
New Smyrna was first settled in 1768 when Scotsman Andrew Turnbull brought hundreds of Greeks, Italians, and Minorcans to Florida. The Minorcans fled the harsh working conditions and found refuge in St. Augustine. Jessica Clark explains that Minorcan cultural influences can still be seen in Northeast Florida, including through the use of dattle peppers.
So the dattle pepper is infamous around these parts. And supposedly the lore is that they only grow in St. John's County. At least that's what I had heard.
Yeah.
But whether it's true or not, I don't think it is.
I think legend has it though.
But, and also that the Minorcans brought them over. Now, I don't think that's accurate as well. I don't know. I hope I don't step on any toes here by saying
you're
that.
You're in trouble.
Right. The Monorgans have lovingly claimed them and have worked them into all kinds of recipes. They are extremely hot. And so, you know, even today, people will dip them in chocolate and put them in brownies and put them in sauces.
And they swear that dipped in chocolate, it takes away all the heat.
I can testify, Dad, and I did some research for one of his cartoons, and chocolate does not take the heat away from a Dad O'Pepper. We know that to be true, right?
Yeah, with the tears.
And that is an illustration of Dad's in his book. I love that one.
Another one of Jessica Clark's favorite stories in her father's booklet is about the British siege of St. Augustine in 1702, when hundreds of residents spent weeks within the walls of the Castillo de San Marcos for protection. Warren Clark's illustration shows people inside the fort dancing, playing music, and celebrating.
Well, Christmas was happening right around then, and so the governor ordered Christmas to be celebrated. Now, it was crowded. It was probably stinky and scary. And
they were running out of food.
But the governor ordered for Christmas to be celebrated. And so Dad has this illustration that I just love. That's one of my favorite ones about celebrating something that is so special to the Christian faith, even in times of real trouble.
We spoke with Warren Clark, creator of the illustrated booklet The Mystique of Spanish La Florida, and his daughter Jessica Clark, a TV reporter in Jacksonville. You can order the booklet at historyillustrations.com/books. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the Tomuqua once occupied over 19,000 square miles in South Georgia and North Florida with a population of around 200,000. The 1564 accounts of René Laudonnière and Jacques Lemoyne and the subsequent engravings by Theodore de Bry are well known to most historians and the public, although the controversies surrounding the authenticity of the engravings are equally well known. Fewer people are likely aware of the 17th century work of Spanish Franciscan friar Francisco Pareja. His Tomuquan grammar, catechisms in the Tomuquan language, and confessional were based on his years of interaction with the Tomuquans near his San Juan del Puerto mission on Fort George Island near Jacksonville. He apparently expected his work to be useful introductions to the Tomuquans for new friars at the mission.
Professor Tamara Shearcliffe Spike used these sources to understand Tomuquan healing practices in an article she published in the Florida Historical Quarterly in the fall of 2015. As she notes, both French and Spanish observers found Tomuquan healing practices to be anti-doctrinal. Pareja's confessional was, quote, intended to enumerate and describe what to the Franciscans were sinful native practices in order to eradicate them among their indigenous charges, end quote. The period under discussion in this article, 1564 to 1613, witnessed profound changes for Florida Indians, including prolonged contact with Europeans, disease, missionization, shifting trade patterns, dietary changes, and slave raids. Quote, Native people's conceptions of identity, gender, culture, religion, and cosmology were challenged, if not outright attacked, end quote. Spike acknowledges that the limited sources do not allow for deep understanding of this change over time. Instead, she notes, the 50-year period provides a snapshot of the first generation after missionization.
Connie, Timucuans, like other indigenous people, suffered an enormous demographic collapse with the introduction of old world diseases like measles, smallpox, mumps, and influenza.
Spike argues that the mission environment exacerbated the problem and helped spread disease. She writes, quote, prohibitions against nudity, less frequent bathing, and confinement in and near missions made Native people more vulnerable to the louse-borne disease of typhus, end quote. In addition, declining health among Timucuans can be attributed to dietary changes, lack of food, increased population density, and forced labor systems. For historians, the records are vague, failing to explicitly identify disease outbreaks, quote, almost always referring to them as plagues, end quote. Archaeological evidence is also less enlightening than one might expect. Spike concludes that Timucuans likely suffered from the newly introduced European diseases, as well as those endemic to North America, including tuberculosis and treponema, a bacteria linked to syphilis.
The cosmologies, the understanding of the origins of the universe, differed significantly between Europeans and indigenous people. The Timucuan cosmology can be seen in their approach to disease. For Pareja, some rites and rituals practiced by the Timucuan healers were acceptable, but others were not, right?
Pareja described Timucuan cosmology in terms of purity sacred, pollution, and impure. The purity sacred symbols and objects included fire, blood, corn, tobacco, and black drink, a caffeinated beverage known as yaupon tea. These symbols used by higher levels of healers were used to create a temporary personal state of purity. Purity was not the nominal state of being. Pollution was the state that endangered humans and included disease, childbirth, flow of blood, and dead bodies. As Spike explained, quote, the concepts of purity and pollution were dyads, interrelated to the sacred. Although individuals could and did achieve a state of ritual purity and could become polluted, it endangered normal individuals, end quote. The third state, impurity, was associated with everyday life, the normative state. Pareja also provided general descriptions of the various types of healers, doctors, herbalists, sorcerers, and midwives. Each of the categories contain overlapping powers. The confessional poses the same questions to all categories, healing with herbs and prayers, and lighting separate fires as a curing rite. Both sorcerers and herbalists were questioned about bewitchment. Herbalists and midwives were asked about childbirth, but only women were questioned about abortion and miscarriage. Sorcerers received special interest from both the Spanish and French. They were associated with magic rites in addition to the other healing rituals. La Donniere also identifies a group he labels as priests who were diviners, advisors, conductors of sacrificial rites, and surgeons. Disease could be controlled magically through the alteration of the environment. Beyond its symbolic value, fire served as a conveyor of medication, uniting the forces of herbal and magical healing when seeds or plants were thrown into the fire and the smoke was inhaled by the diseased. Pareja listed a number of healing practices that he determined were acceptable under church doctrine. Timucuans were basically herbalists, and their medicines were adopted by Europeans. The friar was more concerned about the use of herbs for birth control and to induce abortions. Timucuans and Europeans both utilized bloodletting in their healing. Isolation of the polluted and the dietary descriptions were also described. Moyne identified a fourth group involved in Timucuan healing practices, third gender persons who functioned in a role more like that of nurse, cooking, bathing, and performing basic tasks for the infirm. They also prepared the bodies of the dead and transported them to the burial site. As Spike explained, quote, third persons like shamans, herbalists, and midwives must have been among the select group that were able to successfully negotiate the spiritually dangerous atmosphere, which combined the pollution of illness, the danger of fertility and childbirth, and the purifying agent of the fires, a hypercharged environment of the sacred, both pure and polluted, end quote. Relying on the healing practices of the shaman, the herbalist, the midwife, and the third gender persons, Spike concludes that, quote, in part, through the continuation of these pre-Columbian healing practices, the Tamuquans were able to retain some semblance of a cosmological order on states defined by purity, pollution, and impurity, end quote.
Fascinating information. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. This is Florida Frontiers. Food is an important part of cultural history. Sebastian Garcia has this report on the edible education experience.
Megan Amna is the program manager at the Edible Education Experience. Sarah Bousfield is a master's public history student at the University of Central Florida and a contracted educator for the Edible Education Experience. I spoke with Megan and Sarah about the Edible Education Experience, a 501c3 nonprofit organization in College Park, Florida, that aims to connect the Central Florida community to food through garden and kitchen education that primarily centers on food history. The Edible Education Experience offers youth and adult programs.
It's a wide range audience. So like I said, we have kids programming and adult programming. Our kids programming is definitely more historically based, but we do ages range from 7 to 17. We offer classes for public school, private school, homeschools with our 2.5-hour field trip, as well as some after-school programmings that have been grant funded as well.
As a graduate history student and contracted educator for the Edible Education Experience, Sarah creates programming emphasizing the connections between Florida, agricultural, and public history, all through food.
I focus primarily on the historical aspect. I try to create a building block that builds first on how regenerative farming and the stuff that's being grown in the garden that I'm told to work with, how that sort of interacts with things that may be of local interest. So for example, if we're learning about pineapple and we're working with a Title I school, perhaps there's a way to connect the pineapples that were historically grown in Eatonville as a survival tactic and a method of resilience to, you know, the students who are learning about their community for the first time in a way that brings both agriculture. And I try to do that by connecting them with sources that are accessible. So that's the public history connection, is trying to make this as usable for everybody, regardless of education level.
Megan and Sarah ensure that their programming complements broader state curriculum standards, differentiating the edible education experience from other culinary educational efforts.
That is, I think, one of the things that sets Edible Ed apart in our programming. It's very cross-curricular, because when you hear, oh, it's gardening or it's cooking, you're going to just think, oh, it's gardening and it's cooking. But there are a lot of state standards. There's math standards, science standards, a lot of geography that which goes into the history standards, and then just your basic how to follow rules and work as a team and present orally, like those very basic standards get used in every single class.
And then building off of that, especially for older kids, we have students who come in who may be taking AP classes. And so then trying to bring in, first of all, for fourth graders, they have the standard for local history. But by the time you get to high school, you have to have a knowledge of those larger historical trends, and you have to be able to interact with primary source documents. And so I like to add in things that could be used, you know, to teach students and remind them and prepare them for things, you know, like DBQs that may be on the AP exams or maybe college preparatory classes. So that way they're ready to engage with sources that we're learning about. So could be a recipe, could be a vintage cookbook, asking who's writing things, why are they writing them? Why does this nutritionalist from the 1950s say that you should have 1 pound of fat a week? Things like that.
Several components drive a typical program in the edible education experience, from teaching the historical context in which the food in focus emerged, to cooking the food as historically accurate as possible, to eating as a community.
So our programming is really built off of a generalized model, and then it's Sarah and I, whether it's out of personal interest of different curriculum standards, or sometimes we work with the teachers or even homeschool parents if they're focusing on a certain history. We'll start with like the general theme, so for example, medieval history, and then we'll work our way back into that set curriculum kind of like timeline outline that we have for each class.
And from that generalized curriculum, then I'm able to begin kind of identifying sort of like the major themes that I'm seeing through general historical research, and then focus it and narrow it down to talk about things like agriculture, to talk about separations of class. And like, so if we're talking about the Middle Ages, you know, let's talk about feasting and fasting and how that looked for different people in different socioeconomic status. and in different areas of the world. And so then we're able to kind of create all of that and then find those big threads that we can pull out in 15 to 20 minutes when we're teaching these kids the historical context before they go into the kitchen and then see the dishes that they're going to be working on.
After that, they'll go into our kitchen, which we have 3 to 4 stations. So we have 3 to 4 recipes that we use. They'll split up into their recipes. So each group will make one recipe. And they have about 50 minutes to go through knife skills and then cook their recipes. And then after that portion, they'll be going into like a garden segment, which they actually have most of the time consult with Sarah to see agriculturally what was relevant for that timeline. And then after that, we will join as a community and eat as a group together. So that's another big aspect of our programming is the community part and having a meal together, which is so, so important for everyone to do and really fostering that relationship with our peers as well as our food.
In addition to historical connections between Pineapple and Edenville, Sarah shared another Florida-centric program she created and taught.
We had a summer camp that lasted a week, and every single day was a focus on a different flavor. And so one of the days we talked about the flavor sweet. And so I was burning caramel sauce and talking about sugar and the history of sugar in Florida. So we were able to talk about how children the same age as all of these summer campers in the 1830s as part of the British Empire were boycotting sugar. And we had students who were asking questions, you know, was everyone okay with slavery? No, they weren't. So let's have a conversation about it and let's talk about it. And then I focused it on Florida because Florida sugar is one of the main agricultural industries and it has a very long storied past, even as recent as, you know, World War II and, you know, Lake Okeechobee and the restoration there. And so there's a lot of really local connections that you can make that tie into these larger historical narratives that teachers may not have the time to teach and students may not have the time to engage with.
When I asked why people should care about food history more broadly, Sarah and Megan responded with the following.
Everybody eats. Food history is literally so intrinsically a part of who we all are. One of my favorite quotes about the way that people eat and when you're looking back at recipes is that when you look at a recipe, you are living a million little lives. Because people literally put kinetic energy into the work that they do. And so when you are reading something that someone hundreds of years ago cooked and brought and served to their family, it's a way to bring them to life. And it's a way to kind of keep people and keep communities alive. And I find that so impactful.
It's also a way to broaden our horizons, even with this type of programming, gives people the skills and knowledge to make better choices for themselves and really have that autonomy in their food system again.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS Media Production Assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida, Department of History.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, visit us anytime on our content-rich website at myfloridahistory.org and follow us on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Sebastian Garcia. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.